Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of MixerG, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. Joining me is an entrepreneur who back in the very first internet boom said, you know, it doesn't have to just be on computers. What if we could take all this knowledge that's being generated by the internet and make it available to people by phone? I feel like, Alex, it's one of the reasons why people were excited about the future of technology back then, right?
The fact that you weren't stuck at a computer, but you could connect both with information and people anywhere you went with whatever device was in your hand, that was a really compelling vision for people. And it really did get them excited.
I would even take it beyond that. The fact that you took information outside of the computer made people feel like, what else is possible? We don't know. We're now living in a world where anything could be done.
It made people feel like Star Trek come to life, right? So our first service let you say what you wanted. I'm looking for a Chinese restaurant. I want to see this particular movie. Where is it? And that was Star Trek. That was the guy with the little communicator saying, here's what I need. And I think the fact that that was all connected to the internet just made it really interesting for people.
All right, I should introduce the person whose voice you just heard. His name is Alex Quilici. You're right, it is easier to say Quilici with your hands outstretched the way that you said it. He is the creator back in 1999 of a piece of technology and company called Quack. He sold it to America Online. It became an integral part of one of their services. He is back, or not now, but 13 years ago, came back with Umail. Umail is visual voicemail with spam protection. And I think you guys beat Apple to this, right? The ability to get my voicemail from Umail in text form. I remember getting that from you before Apple, no?
So we were the first for a number of things. So we were the first people to let you get your voicemail off your cell phone where you didn't have to call in and get it, right? Where you could just play it through a visual interface. In our case, we did it on the computer. So you could sit down on your laptop and get your mobile voicemail. That was kind of our first interesting innovation. But we were one of the first to transcribe messages so you could simply read your voicemail. And that's just a fundamentally different way to look at voicemail. I mean, instead of calling someone, hanging up and texting them, you call them, leave a message, and boom, they can read it. It's actually faster and kind of brought voicemail back.
The reason I signed up was because I just want an easy way to forward the message to Andrea, my assistant, and say, here, can you please follow up with this person? They seem to be angry at me, or I don't want to deal with their system. All right, we're going to find out about how he built these two companies, about the sale to America Online, and so much more, thanks to two phenomenal sponsors. The first is a company called Delighted. Oh, they're going to help you delight your customers. You know something that I've discovered, Alex? A lot of the entrepreneurs that I've interviewed here, even post-COVID, if they're doing well, they're still anxious about churn. What if our customers leave us? They're still worried about whether people still like their product. They still want to get a sense of where their business is going. Delighted is going to help them keep their customers and get new customers. And I'm going to talk about that sponsor and my second sponsor, which is TopTal, later on. But first, Alex, do you remember the day you sold to America Online? They were huge in the day when you sold.
I did. It was a spectacular ride from us because we went from being in a literal garage type environment to selling to what was one of the biggest companies in the world in 18 months. So it was a wonderful ride and completely unexpected.
Is it inappropriate to ask you if you got rich from that sale?
You know, if you remember the story, AOL and Time Warner had a little merger and AOL fell apart. So I didn't do as well as I could have done, but you know how entrepreneurs are locked into their stock and there's all sorts of issues. But let's say I'm plenty happy and it's allowed me to do another company.
I remember Ted Turner was famously really upset because he owned a lot of Time Warner stock, and then he ended up owning AOL stock and rode that down a bit. Can you say how much a sale was for back then?
Yeah, it was $200 million.
Wowee. And then by the time you were able to sell it, how much had the shares gone down in value?
Well, remember, so what people forget is they think of an entrepreneur as the face of the company. So when the company sells, the entrepreneur gets a check and then you go buy a Gulfstream and, you know, McLaren's and all that. It's not actually what happens. As you build the company, you have investors, you have partners. I had two co-founders. We were all in it together at the start. We got some angel investors. We went and got some VC money. By the time you put that all together, the pie, it's a big pie. But it starts getting split up. So it's still interesting, but it's not a number like that.
What percentage did you own roughly back then?
Gosh, I can't even remember anymore. It was decent, right? If you figure typical cap table, by the time you sell, the founders have 5, 10, 15% of the company, 20.
Okay.
depends. It's in that ballpark, right?
Back then it was even less because they didn't believe the founder really was worth that much, right? But then again, it's only been 18 months. Where did the idea come from for Quack?
So Quack was really interesting. It was frustration of being in a store to, I think, purchase a mountain bike at the time. Okay. And going, am I getting a good deal or not? I guess I could go home, I could Google, I could, back then it wasn't even Google, right? It was like Alta Vista or whatever. I could go do a bunch of internet searches and see if I could find it somewhere less. But you know, I really want to buy it now. Darn, what do I do? And so the idea was, well, I wish I could just say into the phone what the product is. And this is pre-smartphone. So I could dial a number. I could say it's a specialized mountain bike. It's this brand or this variant. Tell me how much it is online, where it was, and let me choose buy it online or buy it here. So think of it as the very first mobile price shopping. And that's what started us down the whole Quack path.
Now, you didn't create the voice recognition software. I found an old press release where you were talking about your partnership with Lycos, which was one of the big search sites back then, where you said, I can't find it right now, but you said you partnered up with someone else to use their voice recognition technology. Am I right?
Yeah, it was a company called Speechworks. But when you think about building what was then called a voice portal, or what I guess now would be called Siri, right, as an extended version of what we did, the actual handling and recognizing the voice is only a small part of it. It's mapping it to what the person is trying to do. And so we use speech recognition technology, but built a layer on it so that could connect to all the information out on the internet at the time, like the movie show times and the restaurants and your email and a host of other goodies.
How? I mean, we're talking about days before API, before open protocols, before it was accepted that two companies should get data from each other.
You know, so back then, a lot of it, what started out by, let's just scrape sites, build grammars and provide access that way. And if there's interest, go talk to the site and see if we could partner with them. And that's how we got started.
What's an example of a company that you did that with?
I'm actually trying to remember now. I think we had a partner on the weather side. It's been a long time, but we found a place where we could get the weather and they were fine to have us get it. And once we got to AOL, then we had access to all the different AOL verticals, which made it easy. Partner with MoviePhone, partner with, I think it was Digital City, all the companies within AOL.
And so you went to them, you said, we started scraping their data, showing them, look, this is how we can get the weather from your site into our system, and we'll give you credit for being the weather source. Is that what it was?
It was roughly something like that. Yeah. So we'd build the thing, have it running, have it going, then be able to go to folks and say, would you like your data here? Would you like people to access your content this way? And some people were interested, some weren't. I remember some restaurant guide was really unhappy, so we didn't use them.
What was in it for them for giving you their data?
I think initially it was the brand, but there was a model over time where advertising or commerce would be integrated into the portal. And so they would get more business, basically, right? We'd drive traffic to them, or we'd have ads, they'd split the revenue. It was a pretty nascent business model, because we went and got bought so fast, we never really got to launch the product before the initial kind of initial product launch, right? It was initial product launch was, I think, in May of 2000, and we were sold in August of 2000. So all those business model questions never really got answered. We just became part of AOL and became a subscription service, and it was easy once you're part of AOL.
Why did you sell to AOL?
The money. I mean, that's a big part of it. But the other thing for us, as an entrepreneur, you want to impact people as much as you can, right? So when someone gives you a good price and says, you know, we can get you in front of, at the time, it was this astonishing number of 20 plus million AOL subscribers. That's super appealing. We can be the phone interface to AOL email for 20 million people. And I'm going to get paid a lot of money to do it. This seems like a no-brainer. I want to explore this. And that's why it's the combination.
You sold to them, and then they turned it into AOL by phone, right?
Yeah, so that was, think of how Siri lets you access the different pieces of information now on your phone. It includes email, it can include voicemail, it can include other things. Well, we did that way back then with AOL's content. So you could get your email, you could forward your phone line into AOL, and we could get your voicemail. We had weather, we had movie phone. It's gotten to be so long, I'm trying to remember so many other pieces. But the idea was that whole experience of the AOL desktop could eventually be brought over by voice to mobile.
And people could just do it on a flip phone, with 9 numbers, the pound and the star sign, and just be able to get all their data that way.
That's right. And in fact, believe it or not, people could use it from a landline phone too. So your old school landline, it's like calling grandma. You could call and get the weather or call and listen to your email. So there were a lot of different use cases for that kind of model of interacting with the web.
It looks like you stayed at America Online for about 7 years. What did you learn from working at America Online as the VP of voice services?
How hard it is to get anything done in a big company. It's really difficult, right? Uh-huh. So when you're an entrepreneur, you have a story, you tell it to investors, they buy it or they don't, you get some funding and you're off and running. It's your vision, you're gonna push it. And the realities of life will influence where you go. People don't wanna use your product or people use the product differently, but it's a very quick, fast cycle. In a company, you're just selling everybody all the time. I'm selling that I need resources. I'm selling that I need inventory to advertise a service to get it. I'm selling I need people on my project instead of somewhere else. So it's a much different environment where you're not in control. I think it's like a, you know, skateboarding into a brick wall for how it feels. You're so used to going really fast and then just boom.
Was there an example of something that you were especially eager to do that you knew was right and you had to just go through this process of selling?
I really wanted to do phone numbers. So where the phone number would be accessible online, you could make like a soft phone. You could do calls through your computer, could eventually be like a second number you could have access to, second button on your cell phone you press, it dials it, and you could make calls, get calls. So think of like Google Voice, right? I really wanted to do that in 2001. And when we finally got it built, we built it in AIM. So as part of instant messaging in 2005. So it took me 4 years to convince people to do it. And we launched it and everybody's like, ooh, what's the business model? Let's slow it down. So it's not what you experience as an entrepreneur. You get a bunch of people using your product as an entrepreneur. You're like, fine, I'll figure out what to do. In a big company, it's like, oh, our costs are gonna go up. Are we sure we want that? And it's a whole different ballgame.
You know what? Google launched it 2009, years after you. I don't think they ever figured out the business model either, though now it's part of G Suite, so it's an add-on, right? But they didn't figure it out.
I think if you look at who's figuring out second phone lines, it's very specific use cases. So Umail actually has a second phone line service, and we focus it very specifically on the very small business. You're a dog walker, you're a babysitter, you've got a catering business, something that's sort of one person, they're all calling you on your cell phone. You want to move that traffic to another number and use that number for your business. We've seen a lot of success with that model, but you know, there's no way to do that for free. You need to charge people, but you should charge people because they're making money using your service. So it's a fair trade.
Ultimately though, maybe it was right for AOL not to have a push for that, right? Considering that they had a very consumer-based customer base.
I would disagree because if you look at instant messaging, it was used for phone calls all the time, right? People started doing messaging back and forth, and then they had the first audio calls. And what we saw is that the messaging clients expand to take over everything, right? Look at WhatsApp. So it was the first step. It's like, let's become a communication hub on both the mobile phone and on the desktop. And I think AOL was in a really unique position back then to do it. It was before Skype had taken over the whole world. But you know, it's tough because in a big company, if you don't have a great business model, if it's something's gonna take a while and you gotta figure it out, it's a tough place to be. That's why people are entrepreneurs. You go do it separately.
How'd you learn how to sell within a company?
The hard way, right? It's you watch the people who are really good at it and see what they do. And so they find out, they go through an actual process of trying to figure out what people's needs were. More than just, hey, we need to hit these numeric targets, but what does this person want to do with his business? Where does he want to go? And there's a whole process of taking your vision and putting it inside that goal that somebody has so you get a champion. And they do it kind of working up the chain, working with their peers. And gradually your idea kind of fits in with what other people are doing. It's a long, painful process.
Dude, that is so painful. That's like B2B sales for a new product, a new business without any of the upside of a win, right?
Well, the win is if you do get it launched, you get a lot of people on it, right? And you get the satisfaction of something you built and dreamed of being used by a lot of people. So when we first did AOL by phone, everybody thought Ted Leonsis was crazy because he was going to charge $5 a month for it, right? And in the first 6 months, 12 months of launching, we had 500,000 people paying that amount. And, you know, that's a big audience. By the end of 2-3 years, we added other features. We're over 1 million people.
1 million people paying $5 a month to be able to get their email and other services via phone.
Integrated communications, email and voicemail over the phone together, right? By voice, so you're driving, you can do it all. Plus the weather, plus, you know, there's the whole vision of other stuff to fold in there. So back then, that was a lot of money. Remember, that was kind of the dial-up era, right? People weren't, we were one of the first premium services that anybody did.
All right, I want to talk about my first sponsor, and then we'll get back into what happened after you left. Oh, I also want to know, what did you get to buy something for yourself or treat yourself after the sale? But first, I want to tell you about Delighted.com. You know, one of the things I was just talking to the team from Delighted, they told me that before COVID, businesses were asking the net promoter score, how likely are you to tell a friend about this business or recommend us to someone else on a scale of 1 to 10? They're saying that right now, that's just not the right question to ask for many businesses. And I understand this. I don't know about you, Alex, but someone just asked me that question the other day and I gave them a 0 because, to be honest, the market was down that day. And I thought, oh man, what's going to happen to my savings? And then we got a note from the city of San Francisco saying the schools were closed. I go, I'm not recommending anything to anybody right now. Of course, it's going to be a 0. I'm worried that we're still going to be around here as a family. Well, maybe not that dramatic, but you know. And so what Delighted has been noticing is, since Delighted is a way of surveying your audiences, many of their users are asking not just quantitative questions that get people to hit a button to tell them 1 to 5, how happy they are, et cetera, but more open-ended questions about why are you feeling this way about our product? How are you feeling this way about our product? And it's the way to understand whether customers are going to stick around with you or leave, whether somebody who's on the bubble or experiencing your product is going to buy or just move on. And the way to do that is you go to delighted.com/, we're going to give you a URL. Well, you're going to get a great deal where you go to their site, you add this widget to your site, to your emails, so many different ways that you can add it and put in front of your audience. You ask them questions that will get you meaningful information, and Delighted will help you get value and understanding out of that so that you can use what people have told you to actually continue doing business with them. All right. There's so many benefits to using Delighted. They're going to give you an incredible offer, and it's going to be at the URL that Ari's going to put right here because we don't have it yet. It's that fresh of an ad, and Ari's going to put it in.
The URL is delighted.com/Mixergy. That's delighted.com/Mixergy.
Thank you, Ari. Alex, did you buy anything for yourself?
I did. I got my first home. So I went from a rent-controlled apartment in Santa Monica that, you know, could barely fit in to a nice little home in Malibu. So that was pretty cool. My wife and I got a Porsche, which we'd never had. It was always my dream. And mostly we started staying in hotels that were nicer than Motel 6s. Those were the big differences.
Yeah, I'll tell you what. When I sold my company, one thing that I was able to do was go to the Caribbean. And this is such a small thing, Alex, but this, for a guy who never took vacations, that was big. Here's the biggest part for me. There was a guy on jet skis who was just taking people on tours. I said, great, I'm going to go do it. When the thing was over, I had so much fun. I said, can I just pay you one-on-one to do another? I just have never done this type of thing before. He said, sure. And I got to do it. I said, I have the freedom to go and do this. I have the money to say, this guy, how much is it going to cost? And it's not that much. Now I get to finally experience the non-work part of my life that I never was comfortable experiencing. You have anything like that?
You know, it was actually the first time we went out to eat. We said, let's go have a celebratory dinner, right? And I don't know if I'd ever spend more than $100 for two people on dinner. And it was like a $400 dinner. And I didn't feel bad, right? I felt like we had a 4-hour dinner. It was great. It was, I think, John George's in New York. It's like, this is amazing. And I didn't stress like, oh my God, how am I going to pay for this? Or this is going to suck at the end of the month. It was just, this is great.
Little things like that. So then why did you leave America Online?
You know, 5 years is a long time. Actually, almost 6 years is a really long time to be anywhere, right? Especially at a big company. But I'd achieved some goals. I'd made what we did. We proved that we could have a voice portal and drive a lot of usage. We had over 1 million subscribers. I got the second phone number, the AIM phone line service launched. And I sat and said, you know, I want to do the next thing for me. I want to take some time off. I want to spend a year, you know, figuring out what I want to do next, find some idea I'm really in love with and go drive it. And so that's when I left.
What was UMail's history? How did it come about?
It's a really interesting history. There was a call center services company called ZCom, and they had some guys there who had come up with this notion that everybody should get their own greeting, right? Like at a call center, it'd be better if you could just greet the person by name who was coming in automatically and say, "Hey, Alex, please hold, you know, we'll serve you shortly." And they decided they wanted to build a company out of that. So ZCom let them spin off that idea of let's become mobile voicemail that can greet people by name and could access the voicemail on a computer too. So a little bit of productivity, a little bit of fun. So it wasn't fully baked, but I thought it was really interesting to have this little company with this idea that potentially had a big market. If you could sell it to the carriers, you could influence hundreds of millions of people. You could potentially make some real money by becoming the new voice layer within the carriers. And I thought, hey, this is a pretty interesting company. When they came to me, I'll invest. I was at Tech Coast Angels. I'll put some money in and see where it goes and, you know, move on to the next thing. That was the plan.
I remember Tech Coast Angels from when I lived in Southern California. It was a group of entrepreneurs who decided they were all going to listen to pitches together and all go in together and invest, right?
And very importantly, due diligence together. So you got the expertise of people in the group. So when you're doing it by yourself as an angel investor, you don't know everything about everything, right? But if there's an expert who understands the market someone's trying to do better than you, or understands their strategy for biz dev better than you, or has the right contacts, you want that expertise. So the idea was band it up like a group where different people could look at different deals and really help out. And then everybody would kind of get a summary and you could decide what deals you wanted to go into. And I happened to be on the diligence for Umail when they were looking for TCA money, and it's right up my alley. And I thought, well, you know, I don't really like where they are now, but let's put some money in as a group and see where they get.
And at what point did you end up leading the company?
Wow, really, really quickly after that, right? So I think I resigned from AOL in January of 2007, maybe February. I'd been home. I was actually FedExing my badge back to them. And I got a call from a director on the Umail board saying, hey, we need your help. This company is a mess. Can you help us fix it? I'm like, I just put money in this. What do you mean it's a mess? It's been like 2 weeks. They just said, no, we have some issues. I want to talk to you. Do you think you can help?
How did due diligence not bring that up?
You know, one of the problems with diligence is you don't really get to see what all the people are like and how they handle different situations, right? And so sometimes, you know, when somebody's pitching, they're completely different than how they'd be operationally. And the minute they're sitting here with, okay, wait, I've got money, I've got to get back to my shareholders, I've got to get a product built, I've got to do this, they suddenly kind of freeze up a little bit, and it can be really stressful and not quite know what to do. And, you know, you can spot that when it's happening, not necessarily before. And so in this case, the people in the company were just not quite in the right positions, or that was our thought at first. They just needed some guidance, someone to help push them forward on their strategy. And I thought, yeah, sure, I'll do that. And you know, did it as a part-timer for a while and tried to help guide them and make sure they built a product that was good, tried to guide them in who they brought into the team. And after a while, it became apparent the company needed a lot more money if it was going to play in this market. It needed a bigger team. It needed real direction and a full-time person. And I was sort of there to do it. So we ended up having me go full-time at some point in 2007. With a strategy of, you know, build a cool consumer product with the goal of selling it to the carriers and becoming a, you know, white label provider to the carriers. That was Umail's game, Umail version one's game.
I can't believe that you were thinking that you could convince the carriers to buy anything. I felt like, first of all, there aren't that many of them. And second, it doesn't seem like they're open to buying things and adding services. The only thing that they seemed open to was ringtones back then.
You know, it's when you look back at it, it was like, how could we be that stupid, right? But then how could the VCs who put money into that vision been so stupid? How, you know, it's all this delusion of where you think I can sell to a carrier that's 300 million people or 100 million people, even if I'm only getting, you know, 20 cents a person a month. Look at my giant business. It's great.
And that's how you were thinking at the time.
That we were thinking we could scale it at the time. We thought we were pretty differentiated. But I think the big things we learned in our carrier cycle, and we also thought, let's start with medium and smaller carriers and work our way up, right? So it wasn't completely delusional. If we could get some traction, then we become more interesting. I think what we learned is if you can't control your destiny is not going to be one you want. And so with the carriers, we just couldn't control it. We'd get deals with smaller carriers who wouldn't pay, couldn't launch, struggled, you know, medium carriers, we'd get launched, but they would have problems getting there with their users. And it was just, it wasn't working, right? And they had just too much of an entrenched bureaucracy in the carrier beholden to the existing players. So bad idea, very bad idea to do that. But the one good thing was we built a consumer service in order to sell to the carriers. And after 2.5 years, when we were running out of money, because the sales cycle was so long, we just couldn't do it, we realized we had 1 million people who downloaded our BlackBerry app. We're not even paying attention to it. And this thing was, you know, often number one, even in the BlackBerry store. It was a free app, but number one, it'd be in the top 10. It was getting 25,000 downloads in some weeks. It was insane. And so we said, you know what, guys, we blew it with version one. Let's become a consumer company. And that was phase two of UMail, recapping the company, me writing some pretty good sized checks as part of that, and saying, okay, we're now going to go after consumers and see where consumers take us.
And this was also, you launched, I think, before the App Store on iOS, but not much before that. I guess it was called iPhone OS at the time. But the first version, it seems like what you did was, even before BlackBerry, you asked people for their phone number and you're going to do a redirect from the carrier. Is that right?
We still do that. We're the largest place out there that calls are diverted off the carrier networks. So the way voicemail works is a call comes in. If you don't answer it, it gets forwarded to a phone number at your carrier, which has a server answering your call and doing the magic of voicemail. So we said, well, why does it have to forward to the carrier's number? Why can't it forward to us? And sure enough, there's a feature that most cell phones support, GSM supports and CDMA supports, where people can dial a code and a phone number, and that becomes the number that's used for voicemail. Yep. So we thought that's going to be something that's a little bit hard to overcome. We're going to lose some users, but if we can put a good enough product together, they'll be willing to trust us with a voicemail and go through that process.
It's just like something like your phone number, pound, the phone number you want to forward to if you don't get the call, pound, some random thing like that. But once you hit that, your phone says, great, we're going to go for 3 rings and then I'm going to forward you to this number. Or if you do a different code, it automatically will forward all phone calls to that other number, right?
That's right. That's diverting calls off of one destination to another.
And carriers had that even back in 2007?
Three of them did. So T-Mobile, AT&T, and Verizon did. Sprint didn't, but after a couple of years, there were enough people pounding on Sprint's door saying, we want to have these third-party voicemail services. It wasn't just us. Back then, it was Google Voice, I think, was another one that was pretty big. So they said, sure, let's open it up. But why do we care who has voicemail?
Right. They weren't charging for it anyway. But then what did the BlackBerry app do?
So the BlackBerry app was basically like the iPhone visual voicemail for BlackBerry.
It was just a way to see the visual voicemail.
It was a way to see the voicemails. But importantly, especially for BlackBerry users, we had the web component. So if you were sitting at your desk at work, you didn't have to go get your phone and fiddle. Your voicemail just popped up on your computer by email or in a web browser. You could handle everything there. That was huge for business use. And the personal greeting. People love that personal greeting, right? You're in business and you know someone's going to call you, a client who calls you once a month. You can have it greet the client by name and tell them how important they are. You're really sorry you're not there, but you'll call them right back. And having that sort of greeting recorded builds up that connection that you want.
I wouldn't have thought that people would care that much about it, but it is kind of a nice thing. T-Mobile does that now. I think when I call up, they say, welcome, Andrew. We'll be right with you.
There you go.
I always brush over the difficulty of creating a product. How long did it take you to create this product, which did visual voicemail, had an app on BlackBerry for people to see their visual voicemail, greeted people by name. You even had an email component where you would email the message over. How long and how did you create that?
So remember back then, there were no platforms out there to do voice services. So we built our own platform. You can think of it as a super constrained Twilio with the kind of platform services that we needed. So it took a couple of years to build that and improve it to get to the point it could scale well. And then you build the apps as clients of the portal, you know, of that platform where they're using the API to go do various things and you start optimizing the user experience on the phone. So it's an ongoing thing. We like to say that Once we decided to do a real BlackBerry app, it took about a year to get a really good one. But surprisingly, even when it wasn't good, we had a lot of people using it, which is often a sign that you're on the right track, right? You've got people using your product and complaining every day about it, but they don't leave. And so when you have that, you know you need to focus on improving it, but you've got the right idea.
You know, I keep thinking about visual voicemail being the big thing. I'm looking at the list of 11 things that you listed as features in the first version. Visual text, I mean, converting the voice to text was not one of those items. There was a custom greeting based on caller ID, allow people to cancel their voicemail if they started recording something and they sounded dopey, cancel and re-record. You allowed people to, you allowed your customers to play the recording on their desktops. You allowed them to delete the recordings. You had something called ditch mail, which hung up on callers after playing a custom greeting. It wasn't the thing that I know you for, which is a transcript of the voicemail, didn't come till later, it seems like, right?
Yeah, and in fact, there was a long list of features of which only a few mattered. So the personal greeting mattered to people. They liked a different greeting for mom versus their spouse versus a client, right? They loved that feature. People love getting their voicemail away from their mobile phone through email or on their computer. That was big. And then you mentioned ditch mail. And so ditch mail was a really bad name for the feature, but it was basically you could play a do this numbers out of service greeting to specific callers. And so that was designed for, you know, hookups gone bad, getting rid of stalkers, that sort of use case. Sales guys who don't stop calling you. And that was pretty popular. So we kind of built all that stuff because all the economics of it was in our control. We wanted to do voice to text and we eventually got there, but it was really hard to do in a free service. So we had to build a platform back then to accept subscriptions and charge people. And then we could do voicemail to text. It wasn't something you could do for free back in those days. So we always wanted to do it. We thought it was super sexy, something people wanted. And we still beat most of the big handset makers, but it took a while to do that.
Didn't Jamie Siminoff, the guy who ended up creating Ring, he created something like this too, right? Did you guys come out before him?
We were both about the same time. I think Umail was out. He focused on voicemail to text. We focused on the other features. And I think he was out around the same time as us. So he was really about voicemail to text back
then. It was just that. It was stop listening to your voicemail. We'll have it transcribed. And I think he even had humans doing it too.
I remember hearing those stories from Jamie too. So yeah, it was great. He was really focused on the business market. We were focused because we'd been blinded by going after the carriers. We were focused on the consumer market. What features are, you know, what are the soccer moms going to use? What's that feature as opposed to hardcore? Who's going to pay me? We wanted to get scale first and worry about who's going to pay us later.
So the people who were on BlackBerry were not paying you for anything. They were just finding this app, installing it, getting their voicemail through it, having all these features that we just listed. When you discovered that you should just go direct to your customer instead of going through the carriers, how did you add a business model? How did it change what you created?
We did. We realized that, you know, somebody's got to pay for this. So we thought about advertising and we tried it a bit, but it's just until you have massive scale, advertising is not really doing much more than annoying your free customers to hopefully convert to paid to get rid of the ads. That's the main purpose. So we did see, you know, voicemail to text being something that professional users were interested in and telling us they wanted. So we created at the very beginning, it was subscription services like PhoneTag, where you'd pay us for different volumes of messages to be transcribed. And that did really well. We went from zero to 2 million ARR in about, I think, 12 months. Which was really cool as a way to monetize our audience. And had we not done that, we never would have survived, right? Because you've got a burn rate, you've been around for a while. There would have been no reason to take this company and say, well, let's convert it to really focus on consumers and put our investment in and bet on that. But sure enough, that model where we grew pretty fast worked well and got us started.
I wonder how you sold on BlackBerry, how you sold on iOS, but let me take a moment, talk about my second sponsor and then come back and I'll ask you that. My second sponsor, do you know a company called TopTal?
No, I'm about to hear about it though. I want to hear about it.
They have this system. Well, you know what? Let me tell you what people who are listening to this could use TopTal for. Imagine someone's listening to us and says, you know what? I have a few ideas for how voice could help our product, but I don't have developers who know voice design. I think we should add it. I don't know that we want to be distracted by it though. You go to TopTal, they get you the top developers in this space. They introduce you to them. If you like them, you get to hire them. Often you get to get, they get started within days. Often they built what you wanted for other companies. And so they have that experience. And so they could get you the results you're looking for. And if you're happy with it, you can continue to build. You can even ask them to help transition it to your team. You can keep hiring the person if you want and continue to work with them. And the beauty of it is, if it works, you got a person who's experienced, who's setting it up. If it doesn't work, you call back TopTal. You say, this isn't working. We're actually going to cut this off. And you don't have to do layoffs in order to switch direction of your company. Many people who I've interviewed have used TopTal, a lot of them because they've heard me talk about them the way that people are hearing me talk about them right now. If you haven't yet tried them, you owe it to yourself to go to toptal.com/Mixergy. When you use that URL, you'll get on a call with one of their matchers, and they'll help you figure out whether it's a good match and understand what you could expect from working with them. And of course, since you use my URL, you will get 80 hours of developer credit when you pay for your first 80 hours in addition to a no-risk trial period. toptal.com/Mixergy. Do you still like deals, Alex?
Do I like deals?
Yes.
Yeah, I do.
I find that some people are just like, all right, it takes me too much time to care about a deal. I'll just pay full price. And other people will go to the end to make sure that they get the lowest price possible.
You know, for me, the deal has to matter. So I just bought my daughter a Mac because she's going off to high school, and got my wife a new one because she needed a better one than my daughter. And I shop for deals for that, but it's 20 minutes. Oh, here's a $200 coupon. That's good enough. I'm not going to spend a lot of time trying to save money buying cereal.
You know, I think it's Bloomberg that has a podcast called Foundering about, they did a series on WeWork, and they show how in the early days of WeWork, Adam Neumann stood up and told all of his people, we have to be aware of costs. We will lose if we don't pay attention to costs. And you're really hearing him talk to his people saying, shut the lights off. If you're here at night, make sure that you turn things off. We need to save money. Companies die by not saving money. And then fast forward, after he raised a bunch of money, you hear him talking to his employees again saying, are we a company that spends a lot of money? Absolutely. We will continue to be a company that spends. And he's talking about really side by side, hearing these two things is just shocking. It's just shocking.
It's not shocking to me, because in the first case, it was his money. In the second case, it was someone else's money. And it's always easier to spend other people's money. It's really hard to treat their money as if it were your own.
By the way, it was more and more of your own money. I wrote down a note to come back and ask you about how you recapitalized the business. You mentioned it, and I didn't ask a follow-up question. How significant was it? How much of an ownership were you taking in the business?
I put in something close to $2 million over a 3-year period to keep the company going. And I leveraged it where other people came in with me. And that was our way to make it to the point where we got to where we started doing robocall blocking and, you know, started doing the curve in a much better direction. So it was a really significant check, but I really believe that there was a need for third-party services that weren't coming from the carriers that made communications better. And if we could survive, we would find the right, we would eventually find the right path. Our consumers, our business customers, someone would put us on the right path where we'd get some real success.
And so when you were starting to charge, how did you charge BlackBerry users? Were they the first people you were charging?
They were. So one of the great things about email was we have everybody's email address. So we just send them an email saying, hey, we've got a subscription service, click here. They click, they go to a little, you know, site we built where they put in their credit card, and we built a little, we took some open source thing and turned it into a subscription engine. And that's how we got it. In fact, that technique works to this day really, really well.
Well, I'll get to how I've seen you guys work now, but back then, people were coming to you for free service. How do you tell them now it's going to cost money? What were you doing? Where was the line between free and paid?
So there were a couple lines. One was, how much do you use this? I think I forgot what the message box size was, but once you were storing more than 100 messages, which surprisingly a lot of people get there in weeks, you know, if they're, depending on what they're doing, if they're a contractor, they get tons of voicemails, they want to save them. That was one driver. Second driver was, hey, we really don't want to show you ads, so just pay us, we won't show you ads. And number three was the voicemail to text. Like, you could be reading this message, save time and spend a little money, and we'll give you really high quality voicemail to text. So those were the three big drivers that I remember from way back then.
How'd you know what to charge?
We tried different things. In fact, one of the lessons I learned was we started low and tried to move high, and you have to start high and move low. So we didn't know how much our transcription was worth. So we'd start off with like $2.99 a month. Come on, pay us $2.99 or pay us $4.99. And, you know, eventually we realized we could charge $9.99 or $19.99, depending on the volume. So we'd started really, really low, but we were scared, right? We knew all the problems of our product. We figured that meant consumers knew all the problems and they would kind of discount whatever we'd want to charge. And turns out not to be the case. It's people look at how much value do you give them? And you're not perfect, but if you're saving them 10 hours a month, that's worth $10 a month is nothing for that.
What's a problem that you knew with the product that made you hesitant to charge?
It didn't have a great UI. I mean, the user interface was problematic. It was harder to use than I would have liked. I thought there were other, some features were in the website and not in the app. So you'd have to go to the website to configure them. And I thought, that's crazy. Who's going to go to the website to do a bunch of settings? I'm sure I could go back to, 8 years, 9 years or whatever it was and go see the list that we had. But, as the entrepreneur, you've got your whiteboard with, here's my 10 things that suck and I need to fix. And right. That's in your head. And sometimes it's kind of like with kids, you see all the bad things they do and you forget about all the good things they do, right? Hey, you got A's in 6 classes, but I'm going to focus on that B. It's the same thing with the product, right? We're doing some stuff really, really well. And we're all kind of focused on, oh, we're doing this badly.
Oh, I thought I saw a Trio on one of your sites. I was going to ask you about that. Those old phones or something. How big of a share of your market did iPhone end up becoming?
Right now, it's about 50-50 of iPhone users and Android users. So it ended up being we mirror what the marketplace is in the US for those phones.
So what I saw about, so I tried Umail. I forget what, I don't think it was a spam blocking. I think it was visual voicemail that I could email to my assistant so that I could have her give me feedback or handle issues. I think you guys made it easy to use the free version. And then at some point, your emails don't give me the transcript, but say you've hit your limit. It's going to reset in a few days. But if you want to get unlimited, just pay a few bucks. That's the way it works, right?
Yep. In fact, we got more aggressive. So when we email you in the free version, you get the voicemail. You just can't read it. And so when you pay, the transcription is in the emails too. And so for people with a business use case like yours of sharing it, you want your assistant to not have to play the message. You don't want to have to play the message. You just want to forward it. And so people are willing to pay for the transcription and some of the other goodies that come with that.
I have to say, I don't think people understand how annoying it is to listen to audio. Now, I'm doing a podcast and I'm intentionally saying this because people think that because I'm doing a podcast, they could send me audio iMessages on my iPhone. I don't want to listen to it. 2 minutes of you going, hey, Andrew, hope you're doing okay. Things are a little wacky right now, right? But by the way, and no, just let me read it. Twitter came out with their audio tweets and they thought they were geniuses for adding a new feature. Nobody wants to listen to it. Do a transcript. If you're going to let me play it, when I hit play, let me see the text on the screen. Don't you agree?
I agree completely. I mean, the fact is we essentially turned voicemail into a text message so everybody can read it. The audio is still around. And there are times when audio matters, right? Like, my dad left me voicemails and after he passed away, it's great to have his voice. Every so often I can go listen to it, right? And we have a ton of users with a similar use case. Or someone got a message from their friend congratulating them where they actually took the time to call and leave a message. They'll play it hundreds of times over the years. So there is some real power to the human voice, but it's rare. It's the exception, not the rule.
Right. And don't get me wrong. There are times I just want to walk around and listen to it and not have to stand around and read it. I think with Umail, I get to download my message and I get to save it easily, right?
Yep.
I'm not saying they should get rid of it. I'm saying if you do audio at all, don't make people listen to it. Give them a transcript somehow. And if it's in a tweet or something like that, just make it scroll with it. So is visual voicemail still the number one use? I'm looking at the list of features on your site today.
No, it's not actually. So
it's robo-blocking.
It's actually spam protection. So it kind of robocall blocking involved into spam and scam protection. So we talked a little bit about that feature we had that would play the out of service message.
Yeah.
Well, about 4 or 5 years ago, we went and tried to understand how are people really using that feature? And what we saw was people were putting in 1-800 numbers. The same number would show up in a bunch of people's greeting lists. We're like, what's going on? And we realized that the robocalls had become enough of a problem that people were using Umail as a tool to try to get rid of the robocallers. And that was when the light bulb went off in our head saying, we have a massive sensor network of users and data and content that we can use to figure out who the bad guys are automatically. We can use that to provide a really compelling automatic blocking of robocall experience. And so we started building that out. We built some really cool technology to do this. And essentially what happened is Umail became, at least as a free service, about call protection. So we're going to stop the robocalls so you don't get a scammer calling you. If there's a voicemail that comes in for some reason, we'll check if it's a scam or not and put it in a separate folder so you don't have to worry about it. When you go to dial out a number, we'll check if that number is on a bad list and warn you. We started saying we can really protect your whole phone call experience from annoyance, right? The robocalls, and then fraud. So you know, when these guys who aren't even robocalling are calling with scams, you're protected. And we moved in that direction and it's been really good for us. I'm glad we pivoted that way. You still have to have our voicemail to take full advantage of that feature, which is good, but it's really about the spam protection first, voicemail second. For a lot of people, it's like an 80-20 rule, right?
Why is that? I know that I've interviewed a few people who have companies that do nothing but spam protection. What they do is they have a list of numbers that they block, and then the iPhone will, within the phone app, allow me to connect into their list of blocked numbers. You guys handle it differently. You need me to redirect you somehow. How does it work?
So it's two parts. So we still use the iPhone block list, right? And fill in the list of bad numbers. The key though is, how does that list formed? How do you decide what numbers to give Apple so that when calls come in, it's going to be blocked? And so what we do is we use all the content that's coming into our users to say, this number, it's doing an IRS scam call because it matches one of those calls in our database of, you know, bad content. Now we know we can block that number for some period of time, right? So it'll be in the block list for IRS scams, like for one day, because after that they switch the numbers. And so we use the voicemail box in the same way Gmail does to kind of figure out what the content is and does it match bad messages, like scammer messages. If it does, the number's bad and we can block it and put it in the block list. And that's really, you can think of Umail as having a massive sensor network of all these endpoints of traffic coming in, a database of scams, and a way to map the two together that outputs a list of bad guys.
How did you know that was going to be the top feature? You know what? I didn't realize that you guys had changed. I'm now in the App Store. Two things stand out for me. Number one, you have a 4.7 rating out of 5. Dude, isn't that exciting? Do you ever get that framed?
We should, but once again, we look at that and go, dang, where's the other 0.3?
That's pretty high for a platform where people just want to go and complain. I don't see the benefit of telling an app maker your stuff is great. And 64,000 ratings too. So we're not looking at 305 people who said it. It's, wow, it's a lot. So I do see that you guys are now shifting towards saying the free service gives you spam call or robocall blockers. How did you know that was going to become, that was a big thing? What did you do to figure out who your customers were and what they wanted?
Our customers told us, we saw what they were using it for. So they were getting email as a voicemail service and focusing on blocking individual phone numbers left and right. It's like,
how would you even see that? How did you know that that's what they were doing?
So we have ways of counting, like, you know, how many calls are blocked in any given day? Oh, that's going way up. Well, let's see, you know, ratio of numbers, like a histogram of what numbers are being blocked. Oh, there's a few that are blocked by everybody, you know, others are much less. And as you start doing that, you start getting a feel for, geez, what are they doing? And then all of us got robocalls, right? I remember my CTO was doing some work on his house and the contractor was over there and he couldn't have a meeting with the contractor because so many robocalls were coming in. The contractor would go, oh, dang, it's a robocall. Oh, dang, it's a robocall. And it just became obvious, right? And I would go to events and people go, what do you do? I go, well, we're blocking robocalls. Oh, thank God. So it was just this whole feeling like we could see there were all these robocalls that were an issue, right? Consumers didn't like it. And then what we did is we said, you know what, we know which ones are robocalls. Let's estimate what's happening with the country as a whole. So back in late 2015, we said, if our users are representative, we have a big user base. If they're representative and we multiply and extrapolate to the country, what does that look like? And it was like, crap, there's a billion plus robocalls. And of course, it went up to almost 6 over the last 5 years. So we happened to just surf a nice wave there.
Can't believe that the phone carriers haven't handled this better. The government is definitely saying it's not for us to handle. And iPhone and even Android, with all their efforts, they still haven't squashed this. It's shocking.
It's a really, really hard problem to solve. So the way everybody tries to address it is by some sort of reach and frequency heuristic, right? So here's a number calling in. It's calling a whole bunch of people and it's doing it really fast, right? Oh, probably a bad guy. Well, maybe not. Maybe it's the Red Cross desperately getting blood donations because some event just happened. So unless you have the content of calls and you can use that to understand what the call was about, that this was an IRS scam, it was a Social Security imposter, it was an illegal telemarketer. Unless you can see that, you can block the outliers, but not the ones that cause all the harm.
I don't know. It feels to me like
a problem.
It feels like basic CAPTCHA and address book are all we need. If I could give you the 50 phone numbers that are likely to call me and ask you for everybody else to go through some kind of CAPTCHA, that should eliminate almost everyone.
So the problem is it eliminates the good guys too. So you have to build a list of the good guys, like CVS Pharmacy calling. You don't want their robocaller to just be blocked because it doesn't know how to deal with the CAPTCHA, and you don't find out that your insurance didn't cover your medicine and you've got to call CVS. So a CAPTCHA can help, but it's kind of overkill. So at one extreme, you can say, you know what? I'm really antisocial. If it's not in my contact list, don't let them through. We provide that option, right? That's doable. But most people are in the middle. It's like, I just don't want the bad guys to get through. I want Comcast to get through when my payment method failed because I don't want to lose my internet.
And I can't give you Comcast, right? Or suddenly a teacher at my kid's school is using her cell phone to call me because my kid cracked his head open and I got to rush out of the office to go to the hospital, which has happened. Number I don't recognize. I get it. You don't want to block
when
that.
When it's a robocall, like, hey, there was an incident at the school. Don't worry, everybody's safe. And they want to blast it to everybody. If you're hanging up, you're just sitting there going, well, what happened? I don't know. So they need to get their messages through. So to do it right requires some pretty sophisticated technology. And plus, frankly, the bad guys are smart. They're highly motivated. They know how to make tons of calls. They're going to work. They're, it's whack-a-mole with smart moles.
And they work overseas where the laws don't necessarily apply to them.
Yeah.
All right. I was going to give out your website at the end of this, but I feel like that's not the best place for people to go. Anyone who wants to go check out Umail should go to their app store, right? And just check out Umail in there.
Yep, absolutely. And our website's pretty good because we've talked a lot about basic Umail, but we also have the second line service and it's got a great virtual receptionist. So the website talks about that. So I think we become robocall blocking for free, call protection for free, and a really great robocall free second phone number for businesses as our paid tier.
Oh, and that other thing is called auto attendant, where I can say dial 1 to talk to Andrew, dial 2 to talk to Olivia, et cetera, and 1 for sales, 2 for customer service, and then it all goes over to Andrea, my assistant.
That's a great feature, right? Everybody needs an auto attendant.
Yeah, man. All right. Thank you so much for doing this. What's the total sales now? Give me a ballpark.
So we like to say that if we don't clear 10 million by the end of the year, I'm going to be really upset.
So even now, after COVID, you're going to hit over 10 million.
I'm going to be upset if we don't. And we've done surprisingly well through COVID. We were all terrified like everybody else,
but
people are not getting rid of Umail. Umail is serving a need. So we're in good shape now.
All right. If you want to understand your audience and get a sense of how happy they are with your service, how likely they are to continue, how likely they are to buy, how likely they are to cancel, really get in their heads. There's no better service than Delighted. And of course, if you need to hire a developer, go to TopTal. Thank them both. I'm thanking them both for sponsoring. And thank you, Alex.
Right. Thank you.